Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of New Books on Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am your host today, Jingyi Li from the University of Arizona. In today's episode, we have Professor Christopher Joby with us to talk about his new book, The Dutch Language in Japan, a cultural and sociolinguistic study of Dutch as a contact language in Tokugawa and Meiji Japan. Dr. Joby is a historian of language currently at Academia Sinica. This book is a systematic analysis of the ways that the Dutch language circulated, influenced, and was influenced by the Japanese language, as well as other languages that were used in Tokugawa Japan. The Netherlands was one of the few places that maintained trading relationships with early modern Japan, and the Dutch language thus played a very important role in the circulation of information. So, welcome to New Books on Japanese Studies, Professor Joby.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. From this book, I get the impression that your expertise is also in European languages. And I know that you speak or you use many different kinds of languages. So what's your background like and how did you become interested in the history of the Dutch language in Japan?
Good questions. I love languages. I've studied quite a few languages over my career. My first degree was actually in Arabic and Turkish, would you believe? So a little different from this. But I come from East England, and that historically has got a lot of contact with the Low Countries. And we used to go on holiday to Belgium, to Brugge, when I was young. The Belgians, as the Dutch, could speak English well. So I thought, oh, why don't I learn their language? So I bought a book, Teach Yourself Dutch, and started learning the Dutch language. At school, I studied German, which is closely related to Dutch. So that helped my Dutch. So I've always had this passion for Dutch. And when I was doing my PhD, I was actually studying theology, would you believe? How do we get from theology to Dutch in Japan? Let me try and tell you. So I was doing my PhD and had an Erasmus exchange in Amsterdam, where I was able to study the work of Rembrandt and other Dutch artists. And that really fired up my lifelong interest in Dutch again. I completed my PhD in theology, but at a certain point decided I actually wanted to follow the Dutch language and teach the Dutch language. So that kind of got me into teaching Dutch and being involved in that. And your second question, I think, was about how I got into Dutch in Japan.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's another interesting part of the story. I was teaching Dutch, had some part-time jobs in the UK, but in 2013, I got a job teaching Dutch in South Korea. And I took that. I'd never been to South Korea, but I thought that was interesting. And while I was there, I had to teach on the history of the Dutch in East Asia. And that necessarily brought me into contact with the VOC, the Dutch East India Company. And I you know, got to know that the Dutch had had quite a lot of trading activity in Japan. And one thing led to another, and I found an interesting website on the National Diet Library site about Rangaku, you know, the study of Dutch in Japan. And I was absolutely fascinated by that, what happens when one language meets another, when one culture meets another. I think that's at the core of a lot of the work that I do. And I, you know, found out that no one had really written a book about the Dutch language in Japan. I thought, okay, let's do it. If I'd realized what an immense task it was then, I might have decided my time was better spent elsewhere, but I'm very glad I did. And 7 years later, I produced this book.
That's amazing. Everyone who'd read this book, I think they will all be grateful for you spent on the Dutch language in Japan. So of all these languages that you can speak or use, do you have a favorite one?
Well, it is Dutch, funnily enough. I say funnily enough because certainly in the English-speaking world, you know, not many people learn Dutch, in part because the Dutch and the Flemish typically speak very good English, but I've just always had this love for Dutch. Trying to analyze why that is not easy. I think it's in part because it's kind of like English, but it's kind of not like English, if you like. So it's like a close cousin, you know, who you get on with rather than a distant relative, if you like. So I love Dutch, but I love all languages. I love Italian. I love Spanish, Portuguese, Slavic languages. But you have to focus on one area, one language, I think, to really make progress in your academic career. So at a certain point, I decided I had to give up some of those languages, if you like, particularly Italian, in order to focus on Dutch. But I guess this book has allowed me to come back into contact with languages that I'd had to put to one side, like Portuguese, for example, German in the later part of the story, and French. And that was a particularly interesting part of the story, the fact that, you know, we perhaps aren't aware of how many European or Western languages were used in Japan at certain points in its history.
That's truly amazing, and I definitely think it's all reflected in this book.
Great, thank you.
So, since we're talking about the use and influence of language to get into your book, how did the Japanese learn Dutch, and how did the Dutch learn Japanese?
Okay, well, I'll answer the second one first, because that's a bit more straightforward. Technically, the Dutch were prohibited from learning Japanese. Some did do so. You know, there are these prohibitions, but then there are ways around the prohibitions, whether that involves bribes or not, who knows. But some of the Dutch clearly did learn some Japanese. Typically, they were intellectuals. I think of Isaac Titsing, for example. He was the captain or opperhoofd of the Dutch trading post at Deshima in the second half of the 18th century. And he'd studied at Leiden University, clearly a very intelligent man. And he built up a network of Japanese intellectuals, samurai, with whom he corresponded. And typically they'd correspond in Dutch, but, you know, he'd ask them questions about Japanese. From his archives, we see that he was practicing writing in kanji. So, you know, he wouldn't necessarily have been using it in everyday conversation, but certainly had acquired some knowledge of Japanese. Others such as Engelbert Kempfer, the German physician in the late 17th century, also acquired some Japanese. And then Philip von Siebold, perhaps the most famous of the physicians on Deshima, clearly learnt some Japanese as well. So that's that side of things, on the one hand prohibited, but on the other hand, some Dutch were clearly learning it. Some had to leave, actually. Some Dutch in the 17th century were asked to leave by the Japanese authorities because their Japanese was too good. The reason for that, without being too cynical, is probably because I would argue that the Japanese authorities wanted to have interpreters as middlemen between the Dutch traders and the Japanese merchants and intellectuals who they were dealing with. And that allowed them to gain information about what the Dutch were up to. So you could see them perhaps as spies by another name. So I think that's part of the reason for that. Now, going the other way, that's a more complex story. And in the book, I use the phrase kaite, steps, I think is one way you can translate that. And I see the way in which the Japanese acquired a knowledge of Dutch as a series of steps, sometimes forward, sometimes a little sideways, occasionally backwards. But you can see a clear trajectory over time of how the Japanese learnt Dutch, and that became more sophisticated. So they would begin in the first instance by learning by rote from other Japanese. And there were often complaints by the Dutch that the pronunciation of the Dutch by the Japanese wasn't particularly clear, let's say. And that has much to do with the different sound system that Japanese has from Dutch. So they started by learning rote, but that didn't necessarily help them with their understanding of Dutch. So one can imagine that there was quite a bit of miscommunication going on. We have word lists from the 17th, 18th century, and they are often in the Aroha sequence. We haven't yet got to alphabetical or European alphabetical word lists or lexicons at this point. So they're compiling word lists to learn the words to communicate with the Dutch. The next phase is really sort of discursive spaces where Japanese would gather together, for example, in the house of Katsunokawa Hoshu in Edo or Yoshio Kogyo in Nagasaki, and they'd exchange information about the Dutch, about Dutch things. They were crazy about Dutch things. And because they couldn't leave Japan, they had to talk amongst themselves and occasionally try and drag in some Dutch people to help them with their Dutch. So you're gradually seeing a development in the sophistication of the spaces in which the Japanese are learning. And then you start to get shijuku, private schools, being set up in the late 18th century into the 19th century, where Japanese are being taught not only the Dutch language, but also about Dutch learning, in fields such as medicine, chemistry, physics. So you can gradually see a progression over time, the increased sophistication, and then you've also got an increased sophistication in the materials. So you start with these simple word lists. At this point, there's no real grammar of the Dutch language in Japanese. Towards the end of the 18th century, you get a quantum step forward, particularly for the translators, where you've got the Haruma dictionaries. So in the middle of the 18th century, the Dutch imported bilingual French-Dutch dictionaries called Halma by François Halma, a Dutch lexicographer of French descent. So the Japanese intellectuals were using these bilingual French-Dutch dictionaries to create bilingual Japanese-Dutch dictionaries. And what you also see is that there's a shift in terms of the Dutch being put on the left, if you like, so people are able to look up the Dutch word in alphabetical order and then find the Japanese equivalent. And that really helps translation a great deal, because you can imagine trying to translate when you're having to look up the Japanese word first, even though you're translating from Dutch into Japanese. So you've got these Halma dictionaries, the Edo Haruma, and then another one, which was mainly produced by the Dutch Opperhoofd Hendrik Doof, sometimes known as the Zufu Haruma. And in contrast to the Edo Haruma, you've got a native speaker there. And he was able to add a lot of Dutch phrases to his Haruma, his Halma lexicon, sorry. And perhaps finally on that one, you do have a development of Japanese grammars of Dutch. So there's a Dutch grammar by Willem Sewell, which was used as the basis for Japanese grammars like Yaken keys to the language. So in the late in the 19th century, you see a development of grammars and even guides on pronunciation. So by the mid 19th century, you've really got quite a complex picture of learning materials for the Japanese to learn Dutch.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That's quite fascinating. And now that you spoke of translation of Dutch knowledge, I was recently reading a very interesting book on the Langaku network in Tokugawa, Japan, and how translations of Dutch books spread. So from a cultural and social linguistics perspective, how was the Dutch language used in Japan by Japanese people? Like, in what fields were they used? And how would you describe the process that they translated these knowledge, other than the dictionaries you just mentioned?
Sure. I think, again, we can talk in terms of steps. So in 1640s, 1650s, you've got surgeons in Deshima. And what the surgeons are doing, which is what Chinese-trained or Chinese-medicine-trained Japanese physicians are not doing, is opening up the body. Is surgery. And they can see that the Dutch physicians are able to cure patients in a way that Chinese medicine was not able to. And that's happening quite early on. And a key moment is in 1650, where you have a German physician in Edo, who manages to cure one of the courtiers of the shogun of some disease, which the gout, that's right, it was gout, is able to cure the courtier of gout, which the Chinese physicians had not been able to using their approach to medicine, which is more holistic. So quite early on in the story, the Japanese see that Dutch surgery medicine has something to offer them. In the first instance, translations, and we need to understand the word translation quite broadly here, often involves noting down the oral instructions of the surgeon and then translating those instructions into Japanese. Over time, again, the Dutch physicians produce notes that the Japanese translate. And then we start to get Dutch books being imported on medicine and those being translated into Japanese. A book by Adam Kulmus, which was originally written in Latin, was translated into Japanese as Kaitai Shinsho, and that was a key moment because that included people like Sugita Genpaku and Maeno Ryotaku, and they recorded the process by which they translated Dutch into Japanese. So you get a real insight into the problems that they experienced. How do you translate a word like nerve into Japanese when you haven't seen a nerve before? So you get a real insight into the troubles that they had translating from Dutch to Japanese. But over time, as I say, Shijuku private schools were set up for the study of Dutch medicine, Ranpo, and that clearly, you know, they probably ran into their thousands, the number of Japanese who were studying Dutch. And then they would often return to, you know, their domain where they came from and practice the Dutch medicine. So if you like, the Dutch language, Dutch knowledge was spreading throughout Japan. And when I say Dutch, I have to be a bit careful because some of the physicians, as I've already suggested, were German. There was Swedish physicians as well. And their know-how was really more Western rather than specifically Dutch. But Dutch was the medium through which this knowledge was transmitted. And I coined the word metalect in the book to talk about Dutch as a conveyor, a transmitter of information. So medicine was one area. Another area was astronomy. The development of the telescope was an important step forward in astronomy. Obviously, in Europe, that happened in about 1610 in the Dutch Republic. So clearly, the Dutch were able to see the stars, see the sky much better than their Japanese counterparts. And they were able to contribute to producing better calendars for the Japanese. And that helped in terms of agriculture, when to sow your seed, when to harvest, etc. So often, I think Wim Boat sums it up very well. The Japanese translated what they needed to translate. It wasn't a case of the Dutch coming along and saying, "Oh, we've got these books, would you like to translate them?" It's a case of the Japanese saying, "Oh, you do it that way, do you? Or, okay, you have these insights. We want to know more about that." And sometimes that would lead to, you know, a paradigm shift. I think, for example, of botany in the 18th century, Carl Linnaeus developed the binomial system for plant classification. Up to that point, both in Europe and in Japan, plants had often been classified by characteristics, such as what could they cure. But Linnaeus introduced a much more systematic approach, which also ensured that people didn't confuse plants. One could be poisonous, one not. I don't know what I'm dealing with here. Okay. So he introduced that in Latin, but obviously it was the Dutch who were introducing that into Japan. One of his disciples, Carl Thunberg, was a physician in Japan, and he collected specimens of Japanese plants and published a book, Japonica, on Japanese plants using the binomial system developed by Linnaeus. Philip von Siebold, he taught at his private academy, the Narutaki Choko, and one of his students was Ito Keisuke, and he was, sometimes seen as the father of Japanese botany, very important figure there, and he is again using the Linnaean binomial species genus system. So in a whole range of intellectual areas, the Dutch are making contributions to Japan, but it's important to stress it's the Japanese who are deciding what they need rather than, if you like, the Dutch pushing it.
Wow, you raised so many interesting points, some of which I definitely would like to come back to. Mm-hmm. But although the main discussion of this book is about the Dutch language, as you just mentioned, there were other languages used in Japan. What were they, and were they used as, this might be repeating what we're talking about a bit, but were these other languages used in the same fields as Dutch was, and were they learned in the same ways as Dutch was?
Okay, I think we can analyze that in sort of three stages. When Dutch arrived, if you like, and I perhaps go a bit too far in the book, but I try to make Dutch almost a person arriving on the shores of Japan and in 1600 and then asking what happened next. But when the Dutch language came to Japan, Portuguese was already quite well established as the main European language in Japan. This had partly to do with the promulgation of Christianity by Portuguese, but also Spanish and other Catholic missionaries, but also trade. The Portuguese acted as intermediaries between Japan and China because China had prohibited official trade between the two countries. So Portugal, took on the role of commercial intermediary there. So Portuguese was quite well established in Japan, certainly for intellectual life, but also for religious life. And of course, Latin was used, the mass was celebrated in Japan in Latin. But as we all know, towards the end of the 16th century, the Japanese authorities started to clamp down on Christianity, and eventually in 1639, all the Portuguese were expelled after the Shimabara rebellion. But after that, even though there weren't any Portuguese left in Japan, the Portuguese persisted as a language, certainly into the 18th century, and we can ask why was that? Well, it was clearly already well established. Some people already spoke Portuguese, so they were unwilling to switch to it. It's likely that certainly in the 1640s, 1650s, that when Dutch spoke to Japanese, they would use a Portuguese interpreter, which one can imagine led to various bits of miscommunication. So Portuguese persisted, but eventually in about 1670, the governor of Nagasaki started to send the interpreters to the Dutch to learn Dutch. And so that's, Portuguese really starts to decline after that time. But well into the 17th century, Japanese intellectuals are asking the Dutch for Portuguese books, not Dutch books. So clearly Portuguese persists, and you can see it as a competitor to Dutch in early Tokugawa Japan. In the 18th century, there are few other European languages in Japan. So that's really when Dutch shines, if you like. Dutch brings with it Latin and occasionally Japanese translators need to translate from Latin into Japanese. Shizuki Tadao is a good example of that, but he somehow managed to find a Latin-Dutch dictionary to translate a couple of verses of Latin poetry into Japanese. But also Dutch is competing or has contact with Chinese, in the sense that up to this point, Japanese intellectual life is primarily framed by Chinese learning, particularly in the field of medicine. And so in some sense, Dutch is competing with Chinese as the language of medicine. Clearly, Chinese is much more widely known than Dutch at this point. But that doesn't stop Dutch from making some inroads into what had up to that point been primarily a Chinese language discipline, medicine. And then we go into the 19th century, and I think it's 1808, was it? The Phaeton affair was a key turning point. This was the period of Sakoku. Japan wasn't completely closed, but it was open in a very limited way. But in 1808, a British frigate, the Phaeton, gets into Nagasaki Harbour, and the alarm bells start ringing because the Japanese are aware that that shouldn't have happened. And they think they need to start learning some other languages. They get reports, the Fusetsugaki, and they're probably coming to a realization that there are other countries who present a threat. From the north, you've already got Russian ships being sighted off northern Japan, and Russian ships indeed come to Nagasaki to try and open up trade between Russia and Japan. So the Japanese authorities realize that the interpreters need to learn other languages apart from Dutch. They learn English, they learn French to a lesser extent, and there's private learning of German as well. So in the final part of the story, which I look at in particular in chapter 8, but also in chapter 4, I look at how English and French gradually dislodged Dutch, particularly from the intellectual domain. But by early Meiji, Dutch has pretty much disappeared from the scene, certainly as a language of wider communication in Japan.
Now, the key concept of your book, as indicated in the title, contact language. So this process that you just described, how the Dutch language was used as the medium for the Japanese and people from other countries of other languages to communicate, is this what contact language means?
Good question. I've probably interpreted it quite broadly to bring these other languages into the story. Effectively, technically speaking, one can define a contact language as a language that operates in the same socio-semiotic space as other languages, but that obviously needs a bit of unpacking. I guess one can, imagine it that if you've got a group of people speaking one language who are in close contact with a group of people speaking another language, then you have the beginnings of, Dutch or a language as a contact language. And the question is, what happens next? You know, as those two groups, let's say the Dutch and the Japanese in Nagasaki, start to communicate, they realize they haven't necessarily got all the words they need to communicate. So they start borrowing or switching into the other languages. Particularly Japanese is borrowing from Dutch. You know, they might say, what's that? And the Dutch say, it's coffee. We call it coffee, which might be a bit difficult for Japanese to say. So eventually that becomes kohi. Okay, so there you've got the beginning of loan words. A big part of this story hasn't necessarily got to do with people speaking different languages and coming into the same area, but it's to do with translation. So, you know, the Japanese translators are coming into contact with Dutch in books. They want to understand them, so they need to translate them and use their dictionaries to do so. In discussing the previous question, I was really talking in terms of competition. Okay, you've got those two groups of speakers who, you know, might just swap words here and there, but at a certain point, one group might think it's better, or its language is more powerful in some way. And so that one language, language A, starts to dislodge language B. And that was certainly happening at the beginning of the story, where Dutch eventually dislodges Portuguese, and at the end of the story, where English and French and German dislodge Dutch. So when those languages come into contact, there's often an element of competition. So that's part of contact, but it's also about syntactic interference. What do I mean by that? I mean that particularly in terms of translation, in order for people speaking language A to be able to translate from language B into language A, they may lack grammatical structures which they feel they need in order to, you know, capture the full meaning of the source text. So they may need to invent new syntax or reuse particles in different ways to adequately represent what is in the source text. And there are a few examples in the book of particles such as niyote, which are being reused by Japanese translators to bridge that syntactic gap, if you like. And another final aspect, perhaps, of this language contact is that sometimes it results in a shift in script. I don't think that's typically discussed in, if you like, classic studies of language contact. But in this case, I wanted to talk about the fact that you've got two such different scripts. You've got, you know, Japanese with its kanji and its hiragana and its katakana. And then you've got this Dutch alphabetic system, which is based on sound, phonology. Some Japanese found that to be, you know, a simpler way of writing, and even advocated leaving behind the traditional writing system and moving to the Roman script. The Portuguese had in the 1600s had developed a transcription system of Japanese, so that could have been used, something like that could have been used to transcribe the Japanese sounds into a Roman alphabet. But on the other hand, you had Japanese who didn't like the foreign influence that was being exerted, and they saw the writing of Japanese in a foreign script as a step too far. So they certainly, you know, rejected this barbarian script, you know, like people writing sideways. So they eventually won the day, but there were certainly discussions around whether Japanese should be written in Roman script. So yeah, there are different ways. There's loan word borrowing, there's syntactic interference, and on occasion graphic interference as a result of that language contact.
That's absolutely fascinating. And as I was reading your book, I noticed that you quoted Peter Brook a lot. Now, I am a big fan of Peter Brook myself. I find his works on popular culture to be very useful when I analyze the cultural history of early modern Japan. So can you, for a selfish purpose, could you talk more about how Peter Brook's works can be inspiring for your for this study on the Dutch language in Japan?
Lovely question. Thank you. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Peter Brook's work. I typically find that when I want to study a new subject, whatever it is, Peter Brook's been there before. Myself, I wrote a book on multilingualism in the Dutch Republic, which was published in 2014. And Peter Brook had written about a sort of cultural history of the Dutch language in the early modern period. And that really helped me think about the subject in a very productive way. I think what I like particularly about Peter Brook's work is that he frames the subject using apposite phrases. He helps to sum up the main idea in a very good way. So one example would be cultural go-between. I like that idea. Someone's, with a foot in two cultures and enabling cultural transfer from one culture to another, and also linguistic transfer. And that was a particularly productive phrase for me to use in this book. He's done a lot of work on translation. He's an early modernist, and I guess that's one of the caps that I wear. He's written on translation in early modern Europe, and I felt when I was discussing translation in Tokugawa Japan that it would be useful to frame that discussion in similar terms to the way in which Peter Brook had discussed translation in early modern Europe, asking deceptively simple questions like who was translating, how were they translating, what was the effect of this translation on broader society. So, yeah, I really like the way that Peter Brook frames the discussions that he has about cultural history. And also the fact that he's an early modernist means he's often been there before myself, which is very helpful.
So you mentioned early in our conversation that there haven't been a lot of scholarships on this topic because of the difficulty of dealing with multiple languages. So moving towards the end of our conversation, I have one last question for you. Now that you have dealt with almost all the technical issues on Dutch as a contact language in Japan, in this book, what are your next steps and how does this project fit in your entire broader interest of research?
Okay, thank you for that. Just before I answer that question, if I just may make a quick plug for the listeners, the book, The Dutch Language in Japan, 1600 to 1900, is available via the Brill website, and listeners to the podcast can get a 50% discount on the book if they purchase it for themselves or for their institution by the 31st of May. And they need to include the discount code 72150. So hopefully that will, you know, inspire a few purchasers of the book. Then to come to your question, what are my next steps? Well, I'm currently in Taiwan, and I'm here on a fellowship to study the reception of the Christian gospel in Taiwan. And as I occasionally surprise my Taiwanese friends, I tell them that the Dutch were the first Europeans to come to Taiwan in 1624, and they came to trade, but also with the purpose of converting the indigenous Formosans to Christianity. Spanish also came to Taiwan as a sort of counter move in the 80 Years' War, and they also brought with them missionaries who converted northern Formosans. So I look in that book at how the European missionaries tried to bridge what was quite an immense cultural and linguistic gap between their own cultures, you know, informed by Judeo-Christianity, by pagan classical world, by the Renaissance, how they brought the Christian gospel and tried to communicate the Christian gospel to the Formosans, who, of course, would never have heard of the gospel, who spoke completely different languages to the Dutch and Spanish. So that's really, if you like, a case study of reception, but it still somehow involves the Dutch. And then sort of at the other end of the Eurasian continent, I've just written another book on an Anglo-Dutch poet who lived in my hometown of Norwich in the 17th century. And I look at how he formed his literary identity and his military identity, various identities in early modern England. So that book really focuses on the questions of identity formation. So that's, you know, those are two projects which I'm currently involved in. Lastly, I guess, going back to Japan, I would certainly like to do further research in Japan. When you've kind of produced a big book like that, you perhaps need to take a little break, do something else, and then come back to that subject with, you know, fresh enthusiasm. But although I've covered, I'd say, quite a bit of ground, there is still more to do, I think, in Rangaku, particularly in Western languages. And this is the challenge on this particular subject, in that there are books on certain things in Japanese, but not in Western languages, and vice versa. But there's certainly more work to do on Rangaku in a Western language. And perhaps also looking at the story of Christianity in Tokugawa Japan. And, you know, while researching this book, I was very aware that despite the sort of received wisdom that Christianity was banned and no one was practicing it, well, actually, there was quite a lot of activity going on. Certainly, there were Christian books being imported, even though that was technically illegal. So that's certainly a story I'd like to look at more, you know, more deeply, time permitting.
I think it's truly amazing, truly incredible how all these projects are drastically different, but then they connect in some way. It sounds really amazing. Thank you so much for your time and for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you, Jingyi, for having me.
Thank you, listeners, for joining us. To find out more about the interactions between Dutch and Japanese, make sure you check out this new book, The Dutch Language in Japan. And you can find the promotion link, the promotion code, in the description of this book above. This is Jingyi from New Books on Japanese Studies. I will see you in our next episode. Until then, goodbye.